It's Friday, so you know what that means on the Gabe Kuhn Show on 92.9 FM ESPN. That means Parker Fleming joins the show. Make sure you go subscribe to Substack Elitist, his free Grizzlies and NBA draft Substack. All monetary support goes to St. Jude because he's a grade-A human being. He's on X, Paka underscore Flocka. Parker, happy Friday, man. Good to talk with you.
Gabe, it is great to be back on the grade-A show, the Gabe Kuhn Show with you. Even though, like, you know, we're about to hit the dead point of the off season where there's not really any hoops to talk about, but I'm glad that we have even just a little bit to talk about on this Friday afternoon.
Well, I know you're a basketball junkie, but football's right around the corner.
That's so true. You're okay.
Yeah, okay. I feel great.
Yeah, but even then we're still, you know, like a month and a half away from like real football, and then also to this NBA. So it's gonna be a little dead point, but you know what? That's where we get creative. That's where we give our minds a break a little bit before we go right back into it.
Hey, and by the way, define real football for me.
Not preseason football.
Oh, come on! Preseason football's real football. I like seeing the scrubs fight it out for a roster spot. That's fantastic.
I mean, granted, you know what? I'm with you. We're a month away from football because at the same time, we're over here about to talk about NBA Summer League. So, like, I think I'll retract my statement there.
Well, is Summer League real basketball to you?
It is.
Okay.
After being there, it is real basketball to me.
Okay. All right. Now, before we get into Summer League and you get to some Grizzlies, we have to open on the Shams nuke that he dropped yesterday. It was during my show, so like it was in the first segment, so we had to completely upend what we were going to do in the first segment. But Damian Lillard signs back with the Portland Trailblazers, 3 years, $42 million. Next year, he's not going to be playing, but he's still going to be earning money, upwards of $70 million next year while he gets his Achilles all rehabbed. How do you feel about Dame Lillard going back to Portland? Seemingly, he left Portland to go chase championships. Now, it doesn't feel like that's really in his mind anymore. He wants to get back to where he put his roots down, where his family's at. He seems to like the city of Portland, and that seems to be front of mind.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of laid everything out there pretty perfectly. At the end of the day, like Damian Lillard is going to be rehabbing an Achilles injury for a year. And it makes all the sense in the world to go somewhere where you and your family are comfortable in that time. At the same time, you know, Portland did offer more money than anyone else really could have, because I think he signed for what is the equivalent of the non-taxpayer mid-level exception. That's about $10 million more annually than other teams could have offered. With like the taxpayer mid-level, so with teams like Boston or the Lakers or any teams like that, Golden State in the mix, like they're taxpayers, so they can't offer as much as Portland. So like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense all around in that regard. The thing that will kind of draw questions is the basketball sense in this, because Damian Lillard coming off an Achilles injury. And he'll be 36 when he can play in the 26-27 season. They have a lot of young guards like Scoot Henderson, Shaedon Sharpe, and then even if you talk about more of their young core guys like Donovan Tamari Kamara, Denny Avdija, and Young Hansen, that's it. Kind of like, okay, where's this going? But hey, look, this is somebody who can, you know, get some excitement into the arena as this team is looking to make that next step towards competing and making the playoffs, and hopefully, in their case, competing for a championship. Also, too, someone who can be in this gap year where he's recovering, he could be a mentor and kind of lay that organizational standard for these young guys, teach them what it means to be a Portland Trailblazer, while also, too, like what to do to be loved by the city of Portland. You know, it's a bigger than basketball move. I personally enjoy this more than, you know, hearing how the Lakers are about to give LeBron rings 5 and 6 because Damian Lillard is there now. Like, I'd take that any day of the week. So, yeah, it's cool, but let's be real. The reason why he went back is because he saw Young Hansen in Summer League and said, I have to be here.
Yeah, it's better than Yusuf Nurkic the first time around. But I said this yesterday. It feels like more of a nostalgia play than an actual basketball play.
For sure.
But that's okay. That's okay, in my opinion. They still have a young core that could grow up and could mature before our eyes and become a playoff contender. I don't think Dame and signing him does anything to jeopardize that in any way, shape, or form.
No, if we're going to be honest, this team actually might be the deepest, best, most talented team that he's had since the Portland Trailblazers team that the Grizzlies knocked out in the first round of the playoffs 10 years ago that had LaMarcus Aldridge and Nick Batum, Wes Matthews, a young Dame Lillard, a young CJ McCollum. Like, yeah, I think this is about as more talented than them. So who knows where it goes?
Do we give the Blazers credit for sort of how they've operated? Because ultimately, the way this ended up, because Drew Holiday was part of the Dame Lillard trade originally, three-team trade to the Bucks. He was with the Blazers. They traded him to the Celtics. Now they have Drew Holiday. They gave a rental Dame Lillard to the Bucks, and they got Robert Williams III, Malcolm Brogdon, Tumani Kamara, 2029 first-round pick, two first-round pick swaps from the Bucks. Like, it feels like that was, you know, they came out on top when it was all said and done.
Yeah, and then they turned Brogdon into Denny Avdija as well with that 2024 Warriors pick that the Grizzlies had for a long time, traded for Marcus Smart. Portland traded for it because of the Drew Holiday trade that won Boston a championship. And then they got Denny Avdija. Yeah, I mean, you got to give credit to Portland. I think they've done really well with their moves. Frankly, I think one thing that's been nice is even though Scoot hasn't been as advertised out the gate, it's kind of mitigated because of the Avdija trade as well as how well Tumani Kamara has played. Because also, too, Kamara has kind of alleviated the fact that, like, Jeremy Grant hasn't been that good. But, I mean, as far as, like, shrewd planning and stuff, like, you couldn't have predicted, you know, the Boston Celtics wanting to move off of Drew Holiday that easily because of the second apron. But also at the same time, you don't plan on Damian Lillard rupturing his Achilles and then being bought out at a unprecedented even stretch. He's getting paid $20 million a year for the next 5 years by the Milwaukee Bucks to just not play basketball for them at all. You don't plan for that, but you could put yourselves in positions where you could be advantageous, and that's where Portland deserves credit. They didn't try to rush their process and try to just overspend in free agency or overspend in trades just to get good quick. They trusted their process. They trusted their young guys. They accumulated talent, accumulated assets, and put themselves in a position to where they can go get Damian Lillard. And I think something that should be said about that too is I don't think they would have been able to make this move either without going into the tax if they didn't buy out DeAndre Ayton. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think they've operated really well. We'll see what it ultimately means, but hey, it's fun. Sports is supposed to be romantic, and I like that we're getting Damian Lillard back in Portland.
Yeah, 100%. All right, now to Summer League. Grizzlies finish at least the regular play of Summer League 1-3. They have a Sunday game against the Clippers. Does anybody want to watch that game? Do the Grizzlies want to play that game? Probably a more important question. Probably not. But either way, in any case, we've had some second-year players show some strides. Cam Spencer, Jalen Wells, G.G. Jackson. We'll get to Jemiah Meshack, the rookie, in just a moment. But I want to focus on G.G. Jackson here. What have you seen from him in Summer League that you like? Do you think he has made some strides? Obviously, you got to take it with a grain of salt, considering the competition in Summer League. But what have you seen from him? What are your thoughts?
Quick, decisive decision-making. And that's what you kind of want from G.G. Jackson. I know in his original media day presser, he talked about needing to adjust from being a, you know, let me cook kind of guy to a guy that's in the corner, spacing the floor and playing off of others. And, that didn't really manifest in his first year because of all the injuries. They did put him in the position where he could be more of a creator. Second season, he had to learn a new offense, learn to play alongside John Morant, Joe Jackson Jr. and Desmond Bain, and it just didn't work. And, you know, he was out of the rotation, just didn't work out for him that way. It was kind of a lost season. But I will say that, you know, now it's a big year three, and there could be playing time at stake, and there's a new coach that gives him a fresh vision. And I like that there's just no wasted motion. It's him deciding, hey, I'm 6'9", 220, 230 pounds. This guy's not anywhere as big or as strong as I am or as fast as I am. I'm going to use two moves, get to the basket, and dunk on somebody's head. That's great. And then also, too, just regular stationary catch-and-shoot threes. That's stuff that you like to see out of G.G. Jackson. You know, now we'll kind of wait and see what it means playing with John Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr., Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Scottie Pippen Jr., but those are the good first steps. I know people are like, he needs to be a playmaker. He needs to be a defender. Like, yeah, he needs to be a better defender, you know? Like, yeah, for sure. And for him, it's more on putting himself in positions where he's not going to get out of position, keep his guys in front of him, make smart rotations, be locked in and defensively like that, but also with playmaking, like, look, at the end of the day, if he's deciding, hey, I'm going to get downhill in two moves and score the basketball, like, play finishing is valuable too. And, you know, without Zach Edey for a hot second, with Brandon Clark coming off another lower body injury, they need efficient play finishing, and G.G. Jackson has the potential to provide that. So, well, I'm very encouraged by Summer League. I'm cautiously optimistic to see what it means for him going forward. But overall, I think if whatever he wanted to get out of Summer League, I think he got it.
Now, Cam Spencer got the vote of approval, I think, from the Grizzlies front office. Gets the 4-year, $10.5 million deal. Obviously, they had to get the Cole Anthony contract off the books before they ultimately got it done. It was going to be 2 years, 4.5, but it was 4 years, 10.5. So clearly the Grizzlies think that, or at least are taking a bet on Cam Spencer potentially being a part of the rotation going forward. Now, what ultimately is that going to look like? Because year one, I think we're still dealing with a sort of numbers issue for Cam Spencer getting a part of the rotation right now. Year one of his contract, I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now for Cam, it's more of him being, I don't know if he'll be the absolute next man up. I think that one is going to be decided. I think you got to see how the wing rotation shakes out, especially with that backup, quote-unquote, backup small forward spot between Cedric Howard and Vince Williams Jr. Mm-hmm. I also think, too, that at least at the beginning of the season, depending on Jaren Jackson Jr.'s injury, you might see G.G. take up some backup 4 minutes. But I think Cam might not be playing unless either A, there's a lot of entries, or B, if Tomas Isola decides to go 11 or 12 deep with this emphasis on pace and quicker substitution patterns. But here's the thing. I think he's a guy that, especially for his cost and what he provides, like that's a good depth piece. I mean, he's a knockdown shooter. I think that's what he quickly showed in summer league. That's what he's shown at his time in the league so far. I think his touch from beyond the arc is exquisite. Like, he's a high field player. Like, he's not a guy that I don't think he could do like what Luke Kennard did last year and kind of be that like quasi point guard and run the offense in significant doses. But he can make the right pass. He's a guy that can make, you know, beyond the simple pass. He can drive and spray it out to the corner. I mean, for him, it's going to be more about how is he going to hold up defensively, and can his tenacity, which we all know, like, this dude's a dog, like, can that dog factor outweigh his athletic limitations when it comes to NBA defense? That's what's going to ultimately decide Cam Spencer's ceiling as a role player, is how much can A, the dog, and B, the shooting outweigh his athletic limitations? And again, I think the Grizzlies are betting on Cam Spencer being able to do that. I mean, this dude, crazy work ethic. I've watched him in pregame warm-ups, and he's done stuff I've never seen before in terms of, like, he's been out there, like, just for my eye. Like, I get to the games around, like, 5:15. Just to my eye, I've seen him out there, like, three or four different times, which is what you don't typically see out of players. They do their one round or 15-minute session of pregame warm-up, and then they're done. Like, Cam Spencer is actively out there nights for whether he's playing or not. And it's cool to see. Like, you invest in those kind of guys in your culture. So that's kind of my spiel on Cam Spencer.
Now, I'm just going to make a statement. This is not a question. I guess I would love a reaction to the statement. But Jemai Meshack is intriguing. That's my statement.
Yes. You know, I've probably sent the text message several times to different people since drafting Jemai Meshack. Let me preface before I say the text, because Jemai Meshack was not on my radar in the draft. Obviously, I did this big draft guide, 60 scouting reports, and I had a top 75 big board. I'm holding myself accountable. Jemai Meshack was not on my radar until I published my draft guide a week before I released it. I had a smarter guy that does more analytics type stuff rave about him. Cali drafts on X. Santasini had a 59th on his draft board. And I saw Mike Darcy as another NBA draft Substack guy. I was like, I should have put Meshack on my radar. Even texted Sean Coleman that the day of the second round. I'm like, I should have watched him. I just honestly, Chaz Lanier and Igor Milicic were the main NBA guys, sure, at least advertised, and I didn't like them. That's why I didn't really watch a lot of UT. But what I've texted several people several times over the past 2 weeks is I'm about to get irrationally high on Jemai Meshack.
Right, for sure. Like,
because as Sam Fassini said, he might be one of the best perimeter defenders in the world. I like that he's not fazed by screens. At the end of the day, as you saw in the playoffs, deep in the playoffs, you need guys that can guard the opposing team's best players, guard different archetypes, but also not be fazed by ball screens. Jemai Meshack fits all that. And with the offense, you know, the thing that made him the 59th pick in the draft and made him have a bench role for the Tennessee Volunteers was his offense. But I even asked in the rookie intros a few weeks ago, I asked each player, what is your most underrated skill? And Jemai Meshack said, I'm a better shooter than people think. And he showed that quickly in summer league.
Yeah.
The thing that stood out to me is the passing. The passing, I'm like, yo, you're not just making that like extra, like, all right, swing, one more, whatever. He's driving and kicking. He's doing some short role playmaking. He's doing that kind of like, that short role playmaking and stuff that you see from, like, you know, the Alex Caruso's of the world or Bruce Brown, Marcus Smart kind of guys. And can I just, like, have, like, fire off a take that might seem hyperbolic, but
sure,
it's just
why
from
not?
The heart. Out of all the guys the Grizzlies have drafted or signed undrafted and put on two ways, I think Jemai Meshack may end up being the best. He may turn out the best. And I'm saying maybe behind Scottie Pippen, like, but Scottie Pippen Jr. wasn't drafted by the team, but
right.
I just think you watch the NBA playoffs, you watch how deep the teams were that made it far in the conference finals, and you watch the archetypes of these guys. And if the shooting holds up to even 34-35% on decent volume, Jemai Meshack looks the part of those guys, those role players that help teams win big ball games. You know, the Lou Dorts of the world, the Caruso's of the world, the Neesmiths, the Cason Wallace, guys like that. I just think he's going to be, if he just can be a threat from the 3-point line, he is a bona fide NBA rotation player for 10 plus years, and he's going to impact winning basketball at a high level.
Yeah, it's just so funny because he's drafted, and I knew him as one of the best perimeter defenders in college basketball last year, and for good reason. He was phenomenal. But then you sort of sit back and you watch, I think it was his first game in summer league. He goes 3-for-4 from three, and obviously I didn't know him for any type of offense at Tennessee, and you just sit there and you go, wait a second. Wait a minute. And, like, obviously you asked him what, like, you he says he's a better shooter than is advertised. I think he said on multiple occasions, like, I just wasn't asked to play offense at Tennessee. I think all that's showing through. But there, for me, I don't like going overboard with any summer league, you know, generalizations or projections. But he's definitely got me in a moment where I'm saying, wait a second, this guy could be a real rotation player in the NBA.
Yeah, for sure. That's like, granted, I'm not trying to make a huge general overreaction to summer league. It's more about just kind of piecing things together based off of pre-NBA scouting and tape, and also from what we've seen so far, how it fits with the Grizzlies and all that. You know, I'm just like, and seeing where the league's going. I mean, at the end of the day, like, you have to have an elite skill, especially at that size. As a 6'4 guy, you need to have an elite skill. I actually wrote about that today. Guys that are 6'5 or shorter, they need to be elite in at least like one bucket to have value. Because that's the reason why Cole Anthony got bought out, is because he's not elite in anything, and he's 6'2. But I think with Mayshak, the defense is really good. And this isn't a guy that's just like, oh, he's just going to lock you up and that's it. Like, he's also like getting stocks. You know, the guys that can lock up and get stocks, those are the most valuable defenders in the league. You know, I even wrote about it a few weeks ago. The combo guard stopper archetype is the new big 3-and-D wing. You have to go get those guys. And I don't know if Mayshak will provide the playmaking to do that. Who knows? Mm-hmm. The flash has been cool, but I don't think he's like an on-ball guy. But nonetheless, like, this is a guy that I'm definitely just keeping my eye on for his progression. I'm excited for his development because I think he could be a high-impact player for the Grizzlies, but also too, like, let's say it too. You know, Zach Kleiman and Tomas Isola both said they want to identify guys that could resonate with the city, because that's how you build a good team, is when it merges with the identity of the city. Out of all the guys that the Grizzlies brought in,
right?
You know, I think the only other guy that might embody that more than Mayshak is Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who championship veteran. So, yeah, I'm very excited about Jamai Mayshak.
Talking with Parker Fleming at Paka_Flocka on X. Now, final thing, and I know, you know, on various sports talk radio shows, this question's been asked in different ways, but Cooper Flagg played two games for the Mavs in summer league. First one, not very good. 5-for-21 from the field. Only 10 points. It was relatively ugly. Second game, though, 31 points, 10-for-21 from the field. Got back to normal. Still didn't shoot the three ball well. I think he was 1-for-5. But he had 31 points. They shut him down for the rest of summer league. What's fair to expect from Cooper Flagg in his rookie season?
So one thing on Cooper Flagg just in general is I just think watch how he was at Duke. And watch his splits from after he turned 18, like before and after he turned 18 years old. Like, just let him figure it out. Like, that's like that. I think that his year in Duke showed that he's really freaking good when he figures it out. And it doesn't take him long to figure it out. But also, too, I think the big takeaway from Cooper Flagg's summer league doesn't even have to do with just Cooper Flagg, but it's about the Dallas Mavericks as a whole. And I just think that if the Mavericks, Jason Kidd has said this, if they're committed to kind of making him a point guard and making him more of a playmaker, take the under on the Mavericks.
Right.
And that's not an indictment on Cooper Flagg. Like, because also at the end of the day, like, as awesome as like LeBron and Wimby and Anthony Davis and Morris prospects, their teams weren't that good out of the gate. It happens, you know? Maybe the Mavericks are on a different curve because they won 39 games last year, but also too, they're not going to have the Luka Doncic head start, nor are they going to have Kyrie Irving. I mean, their starting point guard on paper and big 2025 and 2026 is D'Angelo Russell in the Western Conference. I'm just not high on the Mavericks for next season. And frankly, I think it's in their best interest to try to get, if they have their first round pick, I think they do. Not, I don't have the energy to check it right now, but I think it'd be actually in their best interest to try to get Cooper Flagg one more guy to be with him in this young core so that they're ready to go after the Kyrie Irving, Anthony Davis iteration of the Dallas Mavericks.
You know, and it's tricky with Cooper Flagg, too, because everybody, like, the hype would sort of equal scoring usually. Like, oh, this guy's going to score at a high level. I know that the first game was ugly on the offensive end that he played. 5 for 21, 10 points. Just didn't look himself on the offensive end. But if you visibly watch that game and didn't look at the box score, he didn't play badly. Like, I thought he played well. He was a good basketball player out there despite not knocking down his shots. He was getting to his spots, just not hitting net, not putting the ball through the rim. But then on the defensive end, he had 3 steals and 1 block in that game. And the 1 block came at the end of the game. He blocks a shot, gets the rebound, gets out on the break, and hits Ryan Nembhard on the wing for a 3 to go ahead. Like,
that's Cooper Flagg, man.
Yeah, you can't. It's so strange because obviously you look at the box score to see how well somebody plays. And when you see 5 for 21 and 10 points for a guy that should be way better than everybody in summer league, like that jumps out at you. But I watched that game cover to cover and I thought he played well. I know that sounds strange.
And Wimby had a pretty bad debut summer league game as well. So it just happens. It's summer league. It's all, you can take some stuff from it, but at the end of the day, most of it is kind of a mirage. So I think the more thing is, like, if there's like a string of bad games, then you're like, oh, wait, what is this? Because also at the end of the day, these guys aren't drafting these guys to play. Like, for some teams, it is the case, like the Wizards and the Hornets. You're not drafting them to play with your summer league team. You're drafting them to fit next to your core. So they drafted, obviously, with Cooper Flagg, there was no denying that he's going to be the number one pick, but they also drafted him because he's going to be playing with Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving, Klay Thompson, Derek Wisely, guys like that. So, like, I don't know. That's kind of what I look at it as, you know?
Yeah. Now, real quick, final thing, LeBron James stuff. Is that over with? Can we stop talking about it? Is he going to stay? He's going to stay in L.A., right? Like, that's all I'm reading.
Can he just announce his retirement tour? Like,
yeah.
You know, like, and I think this whole Lakers stuff, he's just upset that this is the first team that he's on that is not his team.
Well, it's the first time, truthfully, and I'll get to this in a second, actually. It's the first time he's not, like, the head of the snake, like the guy that has to be told everything behind the scenes. But it's kind of funny because I'm old enough to remember Anthony Davis and him when they were paired together not too long ago, and he talked about constantly wanting Anthony Davis to take on the sort of one role, like to be the A player on the team. And then he gets that, and it feels like everything's sort of going left very quickly. Luka Doncic is the best player on that team, and it doesn't seem to jive with LeBron James.
Because also, let's also say this, to call it how it is. Anthony Davis doesn't take the ball out of LeBron's hands to set up an offense. Luka Doncic does. And then also, too, it's a lot easier to say, oh, I want Anthony Davis to take on this role than actually
having it happen.
You know?
Having it happen, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. For sure.
But, yeah. You know, I hope this – I hope it could work out soon. LeBron's been great. Just announce your retirement tour or just be like, hey, I want to get traded. Like, just do one of the two. Don't do all these little theatrics and stuff. Like,
Yeah,
people may eat it up for like ratings and content,
it's definitely greatest hits. It's definitely made the cut on the Gabe Kuhn show more than a couple of times since all this stuff began. But it is, you know, I think at this point in his career, going on 41 years of age, it wears out quickly because this is not the first time we've seen this.
Yeah, like what are you showing to Luka Doncic with all this?
Saying he's setting a bad example for Luka?
I'm just saying in general, what does this mean for Luka Doncic, potential unrestricted free agent in the 2020 season?
Yeah. I guess we'll see. But Parker, I appreciate it. Enjoy your weekend, man. Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Gabe. Have a good weekend.
Yes, sir. He is Parker Fleming. Make sure you go subscribe to his free Grizzlies and NBA Draft Substack Elitist. All monetary support goes to St. Jude because he's a grade A human being. He is on X. Paca_Flocka. We need to go ahead and hop into the Blitz, and coming up on the Blitz, we have some executive orders, potentially, from President Trump, and this time, this executive order that he may sign may affect college athletes' earning potential with name, image, and likeness. Let's talk about that. right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
Now, the biggest stories overloading the line. A bull rush of info. It's Gabe's Blitz on the Gabe Kuhn Show on 92.9 FM ESPN, Memphis' sports station.
Amanda Kristovich at Front Office Sports is reporting that President Trump is actively working on an executive order regarding NIL in college sports. The goal, according to Kristovich, is to limit players' earning potential.
Oh, my gosh. Why do we have to go down this road every single time? Like, why do we have to limit, in a free market, in a capitalistic society, what college student-athletes make? There's no reason to do this. We always hype up capitalism. We always hype up a free market. And then when it comes to young players, young black athletes as well, by the way, I want to mention that, we like to limit it. We have a problem with it when they have the money and they have the power. It's just annoying to me that this is ultimately how this may end up, some executive order to limit, you know, the highest earning players in college sports. I just get frustrated. I'm not surprised by this in the slightest, but it is very, very frustrating. And I will say, like, this is not all President Trump. I think there's, like, former coaches. Nick Saban, I've brought up before on the show. He got out of the game, had problems with NIL and how much money that people were earning. He went and cried to President Trump. And now President Trump is doing what he can to sort of make right on the things that Nick Saban thinks are ill with college sports. So, just frustrating, man. And I hope this doesn't stand. I hope ultimately, even if there is some executive order, it gets reversed by the time there's a new person in office or what have you. I think if this ultimately goes through, there's just going to be more lawsuits trying to break through. I don't think with an executive order he can get the types of antitrust exemptions that a lot of the presidents and athletic directors want in college athletics, especially in Division I. So I think that will be off the table. But he can put a cap on how much an athlete can earn, and I think that's nasty.
I just feel like I'm taking crazy pills, because every single time NIL is brought up and it is being talked about at higher levels of government, it feels like the things that would actually help fix some of the NIL era and the transfer portal, those solutions aren't being discussed yet, and things like this are being discussed. Listen, the amount of money that some of these college athletes are making does give you a little bit of whiplash. I understand it. It's a lot of money. However, I don't understand why we're trying to cap it without having any regulations in place first. It feels like the regulations need to come in place, and then we can talk about whether or not there should be a salary cap. But I'm going to be honest with you. I have no issue with what these student athletes are making when I know how much money these schools are making. Well, I don't understand why we're trying to cap the earning potential of these athletes.
You know what else gives me whiplash? How much coaches make. How much CEOs make. How much public servants, people that are supposed to be our elected officials, end up making. Like, there's other things that give me whiplash. I don't have a problem with athletes making the money that they're making.
I don't either.
I have always called for, like, they're young, so, like, they're getting a lot more money at a younger age, so they need more education around it. But that's neither here nor there. They deserve the money if they have the type of image and likeness that allows them to make that money. It's not that complicated.
It's almost like they have the name, image, and likeness that brings in, you know, millions of dollars to the universities.
Crazy. And they're still only making a tiny little percentage of the revenue they actually generate for the program they're playing in, for the school and the athletic department they're playing for.
Is there any real argument as to why these student athletes should have their earnings capped?
There's no real good reason. No. Try to think like someone who thinks this way. Try to think like President Trump. Try to think like Nick Saban right now. And go ahead and tell me what your reason is behind players being capped.
The people don't want, the schools don't want to pay it.
It's hating. You're hating on these young kids. That's what you're doing.
I don't have a real answer.
You said it earlier, too. This is what bothers me. We want to cap the money, but, like, we're not actually solving the real issues that are plaguing college athletics right now.
This isn't one of the issues that's plaguing college athletics.
How about an executive order on the transfer portal? Sort of figure out that.
Yep.
you know,
contracts,
employers. Yeah, well, but they want to stay away from that.
Hey, we want to cap the amount of money that you can make, but we're not going to call you an employee.
Here's my problem: is like we're throwing an executive order out for this, and this is like the least of the issues with where we're at in college athletics. There's no if a guy's making $2 million a year, $3 million a year, like JT Toppin over at Texas Tech college basketball, that's fine. That's what his market was.
Right.
Like, I have no issue with that. If that $3 million, if you want to make an executive order that he can't transfer or there's some type of contractual obligations you have to have when you sign on to make $3 million, sure, I'm for that.
That makes sense. That would make sense.
But this, if you're just limiting the money they can make, you come across as an unabashed, unafraid
hater.
Obvious hater.
The Commanders and Von Miller have agreed to a one-year deal. The 36-year-old appeared in 13 games last year for the Buffalo Bills and recorded 6 sacks.
Okay. I mean, the Commanders are getting some names. You know what I mean? One thing they do need to do, though, I know they got Von Miller and they brought in Debo Samuel. Sign back Terry McLaurin. Make things right with him.
He has already said he wants to be there long term.
He wants to be there, and Jaden Daniels really likes him.
Yeah.
He really likes him.
Turns out you might want your best wide receiver
in
the building.
Done. But Von Miller, I have no issue with this. Von Miller, for those that think he's completely over the hill, I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. He's sort of a one-year player at this point, sort of a mercenary off the edge that you put out there in situational pass rush downs, on third downs. That's what he did with the Bills last year. And he's still, at 36 years of age, according to Next Gen Stats at ESPN, he has the fastest get-off time. At least last year, he had the fastest recorded get-off time. And that's phrasing. get-off time among active edges in the NFL, right? So there is that. He's still very quick off the ball, and he's very explosive, even at 36 years of age after all the injuries he's dealt with. But he didn't start a game for the Bills last year, had 6 sacks, played in 13. He's just sort of a situational third-down pass rusher, which is very useful in today's day and age. That's how I expect him to be used with the Commanders. The days of him playing every snap and every down, those are gone. But I think he can be very valuable in the role he played with the Bills that I think he'll likely play with the Commanders.
What do you expect from the Commanders this season? Can they replicate the magic of last year?
Sure. Yeah. I hate to say this, though. And I don't want this to come across as hating. Because I think I believe in Jaden Daniels' skill set because it's a little more like he can run very well, uncork the deep ball very well. I think he's got sort of better pieces around him, you know, person for person. But I kind of remember CJ Stroud's rookie year.
Yeah.
What a playoff game. Then they go to the offseason, the Texans, and they just start going crazy. Here's Stephon Diggs. Let's re-sign Nico Collins. Let's, Laremy Tunsil's here. Like, they just started signing and bringing in all these big names.
Loading up.
And then remember last year? Made the playoffs.
Bit of a slump.
Saw a sophomore slump for CJ Stroud. Offense didn't look the same. I hate to say it, but I kind of feel that way about the Commanders right now. They're loading up with a bunch of big names. I'm not saying it's going to end up like it did last year for the Texans, but I think there's some parallels there. If we look 2 years ago, Texans going into that offseason, adding those big names, the Commanders are sort of following that same playbook, going all in on a quarterback, on a rookie deal, while he's still cheap.
Tom Pelissero of NFL Network is reporting that Cowboys edge Micah Parsons' deal, potential extension, could land closer to $45 million per year than $40 million per year.
Patience. Doesn't surprise me. And he's going to show up to camp and prove his worth. In the meantime, hopefully he doesn't get hurt. That'd be pretty brutal. But even if he did get hurt, as long as it wasn't some debilitating Achilles injury, I think you still sign him to whatever you're going to sign him to. But it's well-earned. The guy's been an all-pro 3 or 4 years. The guy is a masterful edge rusher. According to PFF, 94.3 pass rush grade. That was second in the NFL last year, or since entering the league, since he entered the league. 21.3 pass rush win rate. That's second since entering the league. 19.7% pressure rate. That's first since entering the league. He's had double-digit sacks every year of his career. He's been on the field for 16 games or more in every single year of his career. For me, it's just all about the Cowboys and their lack of understanding about how to get extensions done, right? That's why you're sitting here at $45 million per year. If you look at what he said last offseason, Connor?
It was last offseason.
He said, I'll wait. Patience is a virtue. It'll be $40 million by then. Well, it's going to be $45 million now. And like, what just blows me away is, like, the Cowboys' master plan when it comes to building a championship contender or, you know, bringing in and re-signing their best players, it's don't do the extensions when you should. Let players take the heat. Then it's watch the market just balloon, and then you pay more than you ultimately had to initially. And, like, that's their master plan. They did it with Dak Prescott. They did it with CeeDee Lamb. They did it with Zach Martin when he was still in the league, and they're doing it with Micah Parsons. It's hard for me to not bring that up every time Micah Parsons' name comes up on the show.
They played themselves. The richest team in sports. Literally, the richest team in sports absolutely played themselves when it came to this Micah Parsons thing. They could have paid him before T.J. Watt got paid. Before Myles Garrett got paid. And they may have been able to stay under that $40 million number. Because last offseason, I read the quote yesterday on the show because we were talking about it. He said, let CD get paid. Let Dak get paid. I'm going to wait my turn because if they don't pay me, the market's going to go up. The salary cap's going to go up. And I think that number is going to be in the $40 million per year. And guess what? It's in the $40 million per year. And guess what they have to do? Pay Micah Parsons. Because you know what happens if they don't pay him? He's going to walk. And another team's going to pay him.
And he's going to terrorize you.
No sense why they did this. They're betting against themselves. I do not understand why the richest team in sports in the world is penny pinching when it's coming to arguably their best player.
I said it about a month ago. They're
not even arguably. He is their best player.
For the money they're going to pay him now, maybe there's some drawbacks. Like if they pay him $45 million per year, highest paid non-quarterback in NFL history, you know how that goes. You tie up a lot in the salary cap. You're not able to do, work around the edges, work within the margins to get your team better. But
they're the Cowboys.
I said it about a month ago when early off season, Micah Parsons looking for his deal. We didn't know how it was going to sort of shake out. It was before the Myles Garrett extension, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was.
I said this. There's no drawback to bringing back Micah Parsons, the player. He's a top five defensive player in the NFL. He's a top three edge. Like, he's on the same level as T.J. Watt and Myles Garrett. He's more versatile than those guys. You can play him off ball every once in a while. You can tell him to go cover the flat every once in a while. He can do that. He gets a lot of tackles. He can go sideline to sideline if you ask him to. For God's sakes, he played off ball linebackers rookie year. And he's 26. Like, we can't lose sight of that. The two guys that are now that just set back-to-back records for highest-paid non-quarterback in the NFL, Myles Garrett's 29, T.J. Watt's 30. This guy's 26 with a lot of NFL life left to live. I just don't see the drawbacks. I guess at $45 million, there's drawbacks, but you had the power
to change that for yourself. It's $45 million because of you.
If you would have just got it done.
Right.
Just insanity. Insanity. Jerry Jones ain't never going to learn. I've figured that out at this point. But that will do it for the Blitz. One more segment left in the day. We'll go ahead and rewind when we return right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.